Good morning to all. Good to be with you, whether you are someone who is normally a part of this assembly or not. It's a blessing to assemble in the name of our Lord to remember how marvelous he is and how much he's done for all of us. We're going to talk about Jesus this morning, as we've been doing throughout this year, this time from the second half of chapter 15 of Matthew, so the scripture that Brent read for us just now. I encourage you to look closely at it. By way of intro, I'll remind us what Paul said in Romans chapter 1, in 16 and 17, that the gospel, according to God's plan, was first preached to the descendants of Abraham. The gospel is for the Jew first. But Paul didn't just stop there. He said the gospel's also to the Greek. It's also to people who weren't physically descended from Abraham. Remember, from the very beginning of this gospel, we've seen an emphasis on God working on the hearts of his people first. Jesus was born into a Jewish family. He grew up under the law of Moses, studying that, asking questions about it, following it. And he spent almost all of his time within the borders of Israel. This passage here in Matthew is one of the rare occasions where he goes outside of Israel to minister to people who are not Jews. We've seen so far in this book that the Jews that he has worked with are very stubborn people, resistant to his messages, resistant to clear occasions of miraculous events, healings that are taking place right in front of their eyes. And you remember how Jesus has already taught his guys, when you go to a town and they are resistant to the message and they don't want it, what you need to do is stop beating your head against a wall and you need to move on to the next town and go find somebody that will listen. Because the problem is not in the message itself at all. The message heals, the message helps, the message transforms lives, but sometimes people don't want to be transformed. And so, as he's taught his guys to do, so Jesus does. He's been dealing with stubborn Jews for the past several chapters now, on and off, been telling lots of parables, doing things, but now he extends his ministry, broadens his scope to people who were not from Abraham. This is all throughout the Bible story. God extends his hands, God beckons, God says, I want you. I want all of you. And when people reject, he keeps sending out the message further and further until he finds humans who will come. I think all of us need to look at this passage and the stories in it and ask ourselves the question, are we accepting Jesus' call to meet needs that none of us are able to meet ourselves? Because that's what he does in each of these sections here in Matthew 15. Let's talk about this first really remarkable story, and let's talk about where he goes. And let's talk about starting in verse 21, because this is a really shocking verse as it starts this section. Jesus has never before, and best I can tell, will never again leave Israel to this extent. Now, sometimes he'll go into the Decapolis, the regions of the 10 cities. He'll go on the other side of the Sea of Galilee, where there aren't a lot of Jews. But notice from this map that I got on the screen, he goes 20 or 30 miles outside of the green-shaded area where the Jews live. That's their territory. But he's going to Phoenicia. He's going to Tyre and Sidon, even as he tells his guys, my job is to go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But he's not in Israel at all in this particular story. And the names of these two cities of Tyre and Sidon ought to be familiar to us as we've studied the book. Because if you go back to chapter 11, flip back to chapter 11 to verse 21 and 22. Notice what he says to Jews, okay? Woe to you, Chorazin! "Woe to you, Bethsaida, little villages on the edge of the Sea of Galilee, for if the mighty works done in you had been done in, Tyre and Sidon, then they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I tell you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for Tyre and Sidon than for you." And now what does he do a little bit later on in the book? He goes to Tyre and Sidon himself with his miracles, at least one notable miracle, and with his message. He finds a woman who has so much faith that she hunts him down, latches onto him like a leech, and refuses to leave, despite everything that he says in that situation to her, until she gets what she came for and her daughter is healed. So in this surprising place, Jesus has this shocking interaction with this woman. Anytime Jesus has an interaction with a woman, that is in itself a shocking thing. So when you go to John 4, woman at the well, it's shocking that Jesus would speak to a woman, that he would speak to a Samaritan woman. And the same kind of situation is here, that he would speak to a, not just a woman, but a, Matthew calls her a Canaanite woman. And if you know your Old Testament, that word Canaanite is triggering all kinds of teachings in the law and stories that we have about the Canaanites, who were a terrible people, which is why, even though they were given that original land of Palestine, land of Canaan, they lost their land, they lost their power, many of them lost their lives because they chose to ignore God for the idols that they served. And they taught the Israelites to do the same. But, in spite of the judgment that God brought on the Canaanites, he still loved them. He created them. They were not the covenant people. They didn't have the law, this special relationship that God had with the Israelites. But he still loved those other people that he was coming in judgment on. They were made in his image too. And so when Joshua comes into the land, you remember he finds a Canaanite woman in the city of Jericho who was desperate to save her family, and she is helped and she is saved because she's interested in the God of Israel. Now, what do we have here? We find Jesus meeting a Canaanite woman who is desperate to save her family, just like Rahab was, and is also interested in the God of Israel, and so he helps her. Verse 22, what she says here could have come out of the mouth of any fervent Jew. Did you notice that? Look there in verse 22, what she says. "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David." If you go back to chapter 9 in verse 27, what the two blind men say to him, Jewish guys, on the road, is very close to what she says here. "Have mercy on us, Son of David." And so since she calls him that, I think we can infer that Jesus had an international reputation even before he died. And that amongst these people outside of Israel, some of them were believing in him even when the Jews inside of Israel did not. That is amazing. And that just shows you, man, if you want to ask and seek and knock, you might have to knock really, really hard, depending on your situation and who you are and where you are. But man, God's going to open that door for you, and he's going to let you find him if you really want him. This interaction is just, it just is so fascinating to me. So she goes to him. Notice how he does not go up to her. She is not invited into his presence. She finds them somehow, and she is crying out in her request. And you notice his reaction. The text explicitly says he ignores her. He answers her not a word, at least temporarily. And the disciples, maybe taking their cue from that, They go to him and say, well, I mean, if you're not going to answer, let's just send her away. I mean, she's yelling out. She's making a scene. She's a Canaanite woman, for crying out loud. We have come here for R&R or whatever they came there for. And so she's not, we don't need her right now. But notice how he doesn't send her away. He doesn't grant their request. And he doesn't grant her request at first. All he says is, well, you know what, guys? My priority is Israelites. And that's just his answer. So she sticks close to them. She comes and she kneels in his presence and she begs him, please, Lord, help me. And notice what he says again, you're not my priority. That's the meaning of the dogs and the children and the table and the crumbs. You're not my priority. But so notice how a smart aleck response would have been something like this. You're telling me that I don't get any bread when you came to my backyard. You came to my lands and you have the gall to tell me that I don't get any bread? I mean, I'm looking around, Jesus. Do you see a lot of lost sheep of the house of Israel here? You have come to Tyre. You've come to Sidon. You've come to Phoenicia. And you're saying this to me? But she runs with the analogy. She says, okay, what if I am a little dog that hangs out near the master's table? I still get some crumbs too, right? Jesus is so moved by this, he calls it great faith. He heals the daughter instantly. And now we have this beautiful story of what faith looks like in practice. You know, if you're a disciple of Jesus, you're not a little dog under the table. You are a child who is sitting at the table. But God is in the midst of all of his billions of priorities, the billions of lives that he is trying to weave his story into and through. And his first priority is not to make our lives secure and comfortable and convenient. And yet we live in a culture where our society is manufactured and designed to try to cater to us to make our lives secure and comfortable and convenient. When you go to a restaurant today, as some of you probably will on your way to another event today, you're going to go to a place where the workers and the people making the food and the people who are waiting tables are all trying to make your comfort their priority in exchange for the money that you give. When you go to a hospital and you get into a bed, there are dozens of doctors and nurses buzzing around you to make sure that your health is taken care of in return for the money that you give or the money that your insurance company will give them. And for many people, serving Jesus is like that. It's a transactional relationship. Yeah, I will come and I will show up in a building that has Jesus on the sign. And in return, I want good health. I want lots of good friends in my life. I want satisfaction in all kinds of ways. I want creature comforts. I want a good job. But that's not the way that it works. And he does not invite us into this story to say, I'm going to give you everything that your heart desires. He does invite us through this story to keep persistently asking him for the needs that we perceive, that we genuinely need or would like to have. But at the same time, we need to humbly accept that he has his many, many, many priorities. We are just a small part of that. His concerns encompass the planet, dare I say the universe, the heavenly places beyond what we can perceive. And sometimes we just get fixed on our little lives and what we think is so vitally important to have at the moment. I love that we see that attitude in her of humble acceptance with persistence. I want to notice something in this next section. So you notice, starting in verse 29 and going down through verse 31, we have a healing summary. And I want, we've studied these passages already, but I want us to sit in the weight of this thread that runs through the book. So I want to notice these again with you. Go back to chapter 4, please. So this is before the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus is first proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. You see that starting from verse 17. Notice at the end of chapter 4, right before the famous sermon picks up, verse 23, he went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, Gentile land, by the way, and they brought him all the sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, those having seizures, and paralytics, and he healed them all. And great crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis, from Jerusalem and Galilee, and from beyond the Jordan. Go to chapter 8 now, which is right after the Sermon on the Mount. Look at verses 16 and 17. This is right after he has gone into Peter's house and he's healed Peter's mother-in-law. It says, that evening, verse 16, they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word, and he healed all who were sick. And this was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases. And now chapter 9, verse 35 and 36. Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers who are going to do the same kinds of things that I'm doing." Now look at chapter 12, verse 15. Jesus, aware of this context, verse 14, Pharisees are plotting to destroy him. Jesus, aware of this, withdrew from there, and many followed him, and he healed them all. And that fulfills Isaiah's prophecy that he goes on to quote there. Notice chapter 14, 35 and 36. Chapter 14, and when the men of that place recognized him in the land of Gennesaret, they sent around to all that region and brought to him all who were sick, and implored him that they might only touch the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well. And then finally, our section today in 15:29, Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee, and he went up on the mountain and sat down there, and great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. And they put them at his feet, and he healed them. So that the crowd wondered when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. Have you ever noticed how strong that thread is in this gospel? Of how over and over and over Matthew says, he went to a lot of places and he healed a lot of people. And he just says that over and over and over. And this is beside all of the individual miracle stories that we have of him actually doing this on a one-to-one basis. This is beside even the summary that he gives the messengers of John the Baptist when they come and they say, okay, are you really the Messiah? Or should we look for somebody else? And he says, well, go back and read Isaiah. Read about how all these people are being helped and healed because of me. Why are we given all of this? Again and again and again. I think Matthew is saying this. The Messiah's legacy is helping broken people. And this is not a peripheral part of the gospel. This is at the very core of what the gospel of Jesus Christ really is. And if you're a disciple of this rabbi, this has to be your legacy too. It's not optional. This is not, well, this is a nice thing for preachers to do, or somebody who wears a special hat in some kind of way. This is what Christians do. At the funeral of Julie's dad, I heard a lot of neat things about the kind of man that he was. He was smart. He was hardworking. He was educated. He was good at his job. He was a jokester. He connected with his family members. He was brave as he faced his end. All these things were talked about. But what impressed me the most out of all of those things that were discussed is, and I think it was brought up a couple of different times, that he quietly went about helping people who were in need. That's what I want my legacy to be like. That's what you should want your legacy to be like. You remember in Acts chapter 9, there was a disciple named Tabitha, and Luke tells us that she got sick and she died, and Peter was in a nearby town in Lydda. The disciples sent for Peter to come to Joppa, and when he came into the room, there were widows there by the bed. And they were holding the things that Tabitha had made for them in their hands, showing them to Peter and weeping. Is that going to happen after you're dead? What do you want your legacy to be? What do you want people to remember about you? What are they going to have to say? Will they have to say something like, well, he kept a really trim yard that he faithfully mowed 3 times a week? Or, well, he had a great shell collection. He collected a whole lot of doodads and trinkets that he put on a shelf for everybody to see as they walked through his door. That was impressive. Or, well, she really enjoyed exercising. You could find her at the gym pumping that iron, running on that treadmill, running those marathons. Or he really loved watching his sports team. Every time the Yankees were on or whoever it is, he was there cheering them on. A life that is spent in trivial pursuits is a wasted experience. Jesus shows us what meaningful human life looks like. You know, as a thought experiment, if you just went around this room and you asked the other people in this congregation about whether they can remember things that you had done for them, would they be able to give examples? Would much be said about your service to the other lives in this room? Or would people be going, I can't really think of much. I mean, so-and-so's nice. You know, they smile and they come here and they sit on a pew, but I can't really remember them being there for me when it mattered, when I needed something. But they sure were glad when I gave something to them. Jesus cared. Over and over it says he had compassion. And that's why he did what he did. In fact, verse 12 in the very next story, in the feeding of the 4,000, that is what is said about him that powered, that drove his desire to do what he did in this story. So let's talk about that. We have merciful, not just healings going on in this section, but we have merciful feeding as well. And so you notice how Matthew gives us a snapshot of what compassion means. What does it mean? It doesn't just mean I've got some passing thoughts of sympathy that I can see that there's this person and they got this problem and, oh, I really hope that they do better in the future, or they get somebody to help. Now, Jesus' compassion involves three things, three concrete things. It is, number one, he knows about stuff. He's aware of what they're going through. Notice how he calls his disciples together and he has this chat with them. How much time has gone by since the beginning of this little teaching moment? Notice how it says, I know that they've been here for 3 days and they now no longer have anything to eat. So he has kept track of time. By the way, would you like to listen to Jesus for 3 days? Do you get antsy after the sermon has eclipsed 40 minutes? They were there for 3 days. And notice how he is aware of their food supply. All of the packed lunches have disappeared. Everybody has eaten what they came with. There's no longer anything out there. But the people are still there. And he's aware of that. But notice how he is not just aware. He has a willingness to actually do something about it. Real love is shown in action. Isn't that what John says in 1 John 3:18? Little children, let's not just love in word or in a talk, but in deed and in truth. How many times do we see real needs but actually fail to do something about it? This morning in Bible class, we studied Daniel. And you remember in Daniel 4, what Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar to do is show mercy to the oppressed. Is your week, is your month have things on it that have to do with showing mercy to oppressed people? Oppressed in their bodies, oppressed in their souls. There are oppressed people in our group. There are oppressed people outside of our group that we know. There's no lack of people to help. But are we doing something about it? But notice how he didn't do it alone. He recruited. I think that this situation would have gone so much more smoothly and more efficiently, faster, if he had just bypassed his disciples. If he had just clicked his tongue, snapped his fingers, and bread and fish just magically appeared in the laps of all of the people sitting on the grass. It could have happened that way. He didn't have to bring them in. Notice how it says, he called his disciples to him. And I don't know where they all were in this massive scene, because there are thousands and thousands of people here. So maybe there was 30 minutes of trying to gather Matthew from over there and Peter from over there, but he gets them all together and he has this discussion. And he says, okay, guys, here's the situation, which he already knew about. It's not like this is any kind of shock to him. He wanted them to be a part of this, even though they weren't really going to be that helpful. It's kind of like when you recruit your 1-year-old or your 2-year-old to stand up on a bench and help you make dinner. Is that child going to actually contribute in a leaps and bounds kind of way? Well, no, you're going to be doing 99% of the planning and the execution. But why do you do that with your 1-year-old or your 2-year-old? Because that's how they learn. That's how they learn to be helpful. And they're not going to be good at it at first. They're not going to be able to hold the spatula as long as you want them to. They're not going to be able to know when it needs to go into the oven or even be able to open the oven door and put it in. But that's how they learn. Are we doing that, not just with our kids, but are we doing that with each other in a way that Jesus did? It's what compassion is. And it's a beautiful thing. But despite the limited vision of the disciples, who said in verse 33, I don't know how we're possibly going to make this happen. Now, keep in mind, this is the second time Jesus has done this. He has already fed the 5,000, and now we've got the 4,000. This is the same kind of deal, and yet the disciples are saying the same thing of, I don't know how we're going to make this happen. Now, I don't know what was going on. Maybe they did have an amnesia moment. Maybe the situation was different enough that they failed to connect the last bread miracle to this. But regardless, they are really unhelpful helpers. And let's face it, before I come down too hard on the disciples, I'll say sometimes we can be really dense too. Sometimes I can be really dense with trying to have a vision for how to help people that I look at and say, I don't know how to help them. I don't know how we're going to feed them. Maybe sometimes we don't think this person's going to listen to me. Sometimes we just don't know exactly what to say, how to say it. We think the problems around us are too big and we're too small to be able to handle them. What do you say to someone who is currently going through a drug addiction? What do you say to somebody who is dealing with crippling anorexia? What do you say to somebody who's dealing with severe obsessive compulsive disorder or bipolar disorder or sexuality issues, paralyzing fears? I mean, there's a whole list that we could make of real problems in real people's lives that aren't theoretical. And that for some of you, perhaps, you're trying to deal with some of those things. And you're trying to get help. And you don't know what to do. People in those situations need more from us than a message of, you just need to suck it up and have faith. Are you growing in your ability to help with real situations? Are we handing the Lord the few bread and fish that we have and trusting that He's going to be able in His way to multiply the little that we have and bless our efforts? We serve a God who tells us He's given us all things, not some things, not most things, but all things that pertain to life and godliness through the true knowledge of Him who calls us by His own glory and excellence. But can you imagine being here in the shoes of the disciples? You know, some of us have expertise or experience in planning for very large events and feeding lots of people. In fact, Brent and Kendra are about to spend their next week planning and feeding a lot of people at a campground. Thankful for that in advance. But how would you like to be in charge of a food event for 4,000 men? And not just 4,000 men who are going to naturally be hungry. After potentially days of going without food, they're going to be eating everything not nailed down. But also notice that doesn't even count the women and the children who were there in that situation. Jesus has infinite capacity to do things that we don't know how to do. And I want you to notice how there's a really good chance that he's doing this for people who are not Jews. Now, right before this, he's healed a Gentile girl in Tyre and Sidon. And notice how he goes on from there, verse 29, he walks beside the Sea of Galilee. But did you notice the last phrase of verse 31? They glorified the God of Israel. Does that not imply that some of these people were worshiping other gods or glorifying other gods than Israel's God? But now they're honoring this God. And I think this is so neat when you tie this to the Canaanite woman situation, because Jesus has said, it's not right to take bread and give it to dogs. And yet here he is, making lots of bread and giving it to dogs. Because it was always his plan to save all of the nations who wanted to come to him, who wanted his bread. He's got a table spread, and he invites all to come and partake of it. I think that this phrase that you see at the end of the story of the feeding of the 4,000, that they all ate and were satisfied, and just like in the feeding that happened earlier of the 5,000, there are baskets and baskets that are collected where people just could not eat everything that Jesus laid out for them to eat. And there's all this leftovers besides this. But in this verse, in verse 37, where you find this, this is just like what happens in the previous two sections, where he goes and he heals all these people who have all these problems. They are satisfied. And then earlier than that, in Tyre and Sidon, he heals this girl. She is instantly transformed. The end of verse 28 says, and there's resolution there. So in each of these sections, this is the drumbeat. Jesus doesn't leave these people thinking, I mean, Jesus was nice and all, but I was kind of expecting more. I was kind of hoping that he could have helped me additionally. You know, sometimes we have that experience when we go to specialists, we go to doctors, we go to people of reputation and people who have things to say to us, and we think, yeah, but surely there was more to do, more to say. Nobody of sincere heart, at least, left Jesus thinking that. And that caused glory for God. Jesus knows the hearts of everybody in this room, and I don't. But I want to throw this out here, that if you are struggling right now in some kind of big or small way, however we define that, he has the ability to satisfy you on a level that you can never find anywhere else or in anyone else. Are you struggling because you're trying to find a concrete identity in a culture where the message is, you just be you, and you just look inside of your own heart, and you get to decide what your identity is like? Or are you struggling because you've allowed the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches to leach into your soul so that you no longer have the joy and the vitality that God wants his people to enjoy in a life that is lived in him? Or are you struggling because you're tired in some way because you've been working hard in Jesus' kingdom and you're gravitating more toward the sidelines, hoping that other people are going to do what God wants you to do? Whatever you're struggling with, Jesus has real things to say to your soul. He has real work for you to do in this kingdom that he's put us in. real help to give. Some of you already know this, but maybe some of you don't. Yesterday afternoon, Bernardo Pinto gave his life to Jesus Christ. And he was put into this water behind me, and Jesus cleansed him. Maybe there are others among this crowd today that need cleansing, whether for the first time or they need to come back to Jesus. If that is your situation, let him satisfy you. He sure wants to. And even now, as this gospel is still available for us to read and study and absorb, he still holds out his hands. The table is still spread. The bread is ready. The fish is there. He's got to come and eat it. Think about your life. I'll be thinking about mine. And let's stand and sing the song that Ty selected for us.